This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about employment law, but we're focusing on the due process rights of public employees. Believe it or not, that's different than regular private employees, and you'll find out why. My guests are employment law attorneys Ellen Mendelson, who represents public employees. Her offices are in San Francisco. And my other guest is Alfonso Estrada, who represents public entities. He's an associate in the Cerritos, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo. Alfonso, did I get Rood correctly pronounced?
Yes, you did.
Oh, good. I'm glad of that. Let me let all of you know, who, if you're listening to the live program, and we're doing this on Wednesday, January 27th, we're doing our regular Call a Lawyer night, which we usually do on the fourth Wednesday of the month. So if any of you have questions about the law that you would like to speak to an attorney off the air, no obligation on your part whatsoever, jot down this number, if you would, 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. Now, let me let you know this. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding for the program is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Let me ask you to do this, if you would, and I think this is important because I don't have any recollection in the near 32 years that I have been doing this program of ever doing a program on public employee law. Ellen, would you start very briefly? Tell us, what do you see your role as an attorney who represents public employees? Briefly, if you would.
Yes. As an advocate for public employees, my role is to ensure that the public employee is being treated fairly by the employer in terms of discipline, termination, discharge. The public employer is required to follow the rules in relation to its continued employment of the public employee, and because the public employee has a constitutionally protected interest in the receipt of his paycheck, the public employer is required to provide due process of law before they discipline or discharge. And my role is to ensure that those requirements are being followed by the public employer.
Now, Alfonso, how do you view, in summary, brief summary, your role as an attorney who's representing public entities?
Sure. I represent public entities in all legal matters. Specifically, a significant portion of my practice relates to employee discipline. When a public entity decides to take disciplinary action against employees, there are procedural requirements that they have to follow, which Ellen spoke to some just now. As part of that, I represent public entities in investigating potential employee misconduct, to making sure that the discipline, if there is any misconduct, the level of the discipline is fair, to putting on administrative hearings in an effort to sustain the decision concerning discipline that has been made by the public entity, and then to present the case from there, the evidentiary hearing, to the arbitrator or hearing officer, whatever it may be, to ultimately get a decision from that hearing officer and or arbitrator to determine whether or not there was sufficient cause for the discipline that had been handed out by the public entity. So I deal with it from the beginning to the end.
All right, let me throw this out to you. I think most people who are not lawyers and who are not certainly employment law attorneys understand that unless you have if you're a private employee, that is, you're an employee working for a private company, not a public entity, that unless you have a contract with that employer, your employment, it really is at will. Now, could you, both of you, talk briefly about the distinction between a private employee and a civil servant employee with respect to the at-will concept?
Labor Code 2922 says that unless there is a contract for a term all employment in the state of California is at will, which means an employee can be fired for any reason or no reason.
That's very arbitrary.
It can be. Much different than the rights of a public sector employee, whose rights are typically, as Ellen stated in her opening, a constitutionally protected right to their paycheck or their pay or their employment. Whereas an employee in the private sector, it's an arm's length agreement with their employer. They're completely at will, and they cannot be they can be terminated for any reason except for any discriminatory or illegal action on behalf of the employer. So there is a big dichotomy between the two, but because of that risk that comes with private employment, typically employees in the private sector are compensated more than public sector employees. That's kind of the trade-off. With a public employee, you get added security in your position, less pay. In the private sector, you get pretty much little to none, but you typically get higher pay.
I think one of the things that I'd like to let the listeners know about, there is a, actually it goes back to 1985. The U.S. Supreme Court came out with the decision, Cleveland Board of Education versus Loudermill, which held that the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution requires that a government employee who has a significant property interest in his or her employment and therefore must be given due process, the opportunity for a hearing before he or she is discharged. Can you briefly talk about this, Ellen? Is this where we come up with the due process procedures that are required today?
Yes, and this is, and there are a number of different steps in the process. Before a public employee's pay can be interrupted, they are entitled to a brief hearing. It's called a Skelly hearing.
S-K-E-L-L-Y.
Right, at which they have an opportunity to say why they should not be disciplined or discharged. They can provide evidence to support the claim they should not be disciplined or discharged. And they are entitled to a written decision that makes a determination as to whether they should be disciplined or discharged.
So if they get a written decision that says the discharge or the discipline was appropriate, what can the public employee do next?
They have appeal rights after that. They have a right to a quasi-judicial hearing at which they can present witnesses and testimony to show that they should not be disciplined or discharged.
And just to add on to that, Ellen, typically the venue in which those disciplinary cases are heard, it can vary widely from public entity to public entity, depending on what their agreement is with their unions and their MOUs or CBAs. Typically what you see is either advisory or binding arbitration, where an independent arbitrator is brought in by agreement of the parties to essentially determine whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support the employer's decision to either terminate or to discipline the employee. You also see in other public entities, other venues, there could be a civil service commission or a board of rights that basically gets to hear all of the evidence put on by the union side, which would be Ellen, and the employer side, which would be what I do, and then ultimately make a determination one way or the other if a preponderance of the evidence supports the reasons for the discipline against the public employee.
All right, let me ask you this, because most of us don't know what preponderance of the evidence means. What does it mean?
51%. You just have to tip the scale.
It's brother.
Ellen. I typically say 50% and a feather.
And a feather.
That's true.
That's hilarious.
And it's different. You know, if we look in the criminal forum, it's always beyond
a reasonable doubt. But this is not the same.
This is not the same. And I've been involved in cases. In cases where we have conduct issues or involve an employee's liberty interest, cases that are charging theft or some kind of conduct that will end up tarring the employee's reputation, I always argue that the standard of proof should be higher than preponderance, clear and convincing evidence. And I've succeeded at that, and I've not succeeded at that at times.
Well, Joanne, I'd like to take a brief break, if we could, for a moment here. Everybody, I want to let you know, this is our regular Call a Lawyer night. I want to give you the number, 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, no obligation on your part. Alice O'Sullivan will take calls during the course of the program. If you'd like to call her during the course of the program, area code 510-333-3314, area code 510-333-3314, workers' comp. We have attorneys here at the station for criminal law, family law, landlord-tenant, employment law, tax law, real estate law, patent law, aviation law. And so you're welcome to call in to our Call a Lawyer number, 1-800-525-9917. At about 7:27 or so, I'll invite you to call in to the program. And that number, toll-free, 866-798-8255. Okay, the steps, you know, one of the things that you just said, actually, Alfonso, you talked about advisory arbitration and also, I believe you said, binding arbitration. What can you explain to us, what does advisory arbitration mean, Alfonso?
Absolutely.
Please.
Some public entities, cities, counties, whatever it may be, in their contracts that they form with their unions as to how discipline will be governed for their employees, have these clauses that permit advisory arbitration. And what I mean by that is that an independent arbitrator or hearing officer is brought in to hear the evidence from both sides. Obviously, the union will be arguing that the discipline was not justified and that there wasn't sufficient cause or evidence supporting good cause for the discipline. The employer will be arguing, obviously, that we made the right decision and it's supported by ample evidence for cause. The arbitrator will then make findings and give an award. And that in those findings and award, he will give the reasons why he believes the discipline should be sustained or not sustained. Typically, when it's advisory, the decision then from the arbitrator goes either before city council, city manager, whatever the parties have contracted for. And then, based upon that advisory decision, the city manager or the majority of the city council would vote whether to adopt or reject the advisory arbitration decision that has been rendered.
What about binding arbitration? What is that? How does that work?
The employer stuck with the decision and the employee stuck with the decision.
So briefly explain that, would you, Alfonso?
Sure. The alternative is binding arbitration,
yeah.
Which I find more common, generally I like it more because there's some finality to it, more immediate for both the employer and the employee. Typically what that would entail is, again, there's an evidentiary hearing. It's all typically done, you know, with a court reporter. You present evidence, exhibits, put on your case, the union puts on its case. At the conclusion of that, again, there is an arbitration award and decision that is rendered. However, there is no further appeal, at least within the structure of the public entity, at that point. At that point, whatever the arbitrator has decided becomes the outcome, whether the discipline was justified and sustained or whether there was not a preponderance of the evidence supporting the charges brought against the employee for the misconduct. The employee can be reinstated and given back pay for the time that they were off pay, or whatever remedy the arbitrator deems appropriate.
If the arbitrator concluded that the discipline was appropriate, and we're talking now about binding arbitration, does that mean, Ellen, that the public employee has no further appeal process at all under California law?
No. Under California law, the employee can then take the matter to the Superior Court on a petition for a writ of administrative mandamus under CCP, California Code of Civil Procedure 1094.5. The burden on such a writ is incredibly heavy. And you have to show that the hearing officer abused his or her discretion in issuing the decision issued, that the decision is not supported by the findings, that the findings are not supported by the evidence, or that there was some bias present that prevented the employee from getting a fair trial.
Well, that sounds like nearly getting to the point of beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's close.
Is it really?
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. It's okay. The burden on it, the place to win these things, if you can't, on the place to win these things is at the administrative hearing. And sometimes that's very difficult because the hearing officers are generally selected by the entity. They're compensated by the entity. And you have the repeat business issue where, you know, you have a single soul. And public employee things are very difficult to challenge and to win.
Alfonso, let me throw this out to you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
With what Ellen just said, if the hearing officer or officers are chosen by the employer, are paid by the employer, it sounds like there's an inherent bias.
Yeah, my response to that would be that typically the fees for the arbitrator are split between a union and an employer.
Ah.
So that, in some respects, mitigates any
Good.
Potential bias.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah.
And those are in the cases with the union. I know the grievance belongs to the union, but if the union won't pursue a grievance, the employee can at times push things on their own.
Now, this is a very significant issue. If the union will not pursue this, and you as a public employee are a member of the union, it sounds like the public employee is left hanging out there.
Well, generally, they have their own enforcement rights, but and generally, if the union...
Well, that can be very expensive for a public employee.
Sure.
Yes.
Also, there is some case law that's come out more recently that states that if it is an individual specifically representing themselves against a public entity, that the public employer at that point would be responsible for paying the cost of essentially allowing them to exhaust their due process rights. Ellen, I'm sure you've
yes,
you've
yeah,
heard
absolutely,
of it.
And I do argue that.
Yeah, and it's becoming a more compelling argument. There is more case law out there supporting it, and I think generally as a public employer, it's becoming a better practice. However, typically, these types of disputes are paid for by the union. And the costs are split down the middle to prevent any bias or potential bias for the arbitrator or hearing officer, which I think is the way it should be.
And do you agree with that, Ellen? Do you agree that is okay?
Absolutely.
All right. So that to me sounds like it's incredibly trying to be fair to both sides of this. And does the union, however, with respect to the choosing of the hearing officer, does the union, generally speaking, at least in California, does the union play any role along with the employer in selecting the hearing officer, or is it always the employer who selects the hearing officer?
No, typically there's various ways that this is handled. It's either pre-negotiated in the contract. There's like a list of arbitrators or hearing officers that both parties agree to have on that list, and then there's a striking. So let's say Ellen is representing an employee of a public entity that I represent. We've issued discipline to that employee. We've gone through the Skelly process. It's been appealed to arbitration. At that point, from that list, she would strike one, I would strike one, she would strike one, until we get to one individual left on that list. And there's also lists from the State Mediation and Conciliation Service that are typically used, and it has, they send you a list of seven. You set a time with the union counsel or advocate to meet and go through the strike list, and ultimately you arrive at a decision as to who your arbitrator will be. With that said, we keep a repository of arbitrators' decisions. You kind of either develop a rapport with an arbitrator or hearing officer over the years, so you kind of know who you like. I'm sure the union knows who they like. So through that process, I think it's also fair because, both sides get an opportunity to strike people that they wouldn't necessarily think would be the right fit for a particular case.
Let me interrupt you right now for just a moment. It's our regular Call a Lawyer night, the fourth Wednesday of the month. The number is 1-800-525-9917. You're welcome to call in, speak to an attorney off the air. No obligation on your part whatsoever. This is a public service these attorneys are doing. They are members of either the San Francisco Bar or the San Mateo County Bar. Most of these people have been doing this for years in conjunction with this program. And so the number again, 1-800-525-9917. In about 7 minutes, I will invite you to call in, ask a question, make a comment on the air. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to jot it down, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. This is Your Legal Rights. If you've tuned in a little bit late, we're talking about something that is different from the regular private employee rights under labor and employment law in California. We're talking about the due process rights of public employees. My guests are Alfonso Estrada, who represents public entities. He's an associate with the law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo in Cerritos, California. My other guest in the studio with me is Ellen Mendelson, who represents public employees. Her office is in San Francisco. And what I'd like to do before we end the statewide version, which is one in the next few minutes we will end, and it is recorded and sent out to 15 other stations in California that air the program the following week. What have we not even touched upon that you feel is important enough that you want to include in within the next, let's say, 5 minutes or so?
Ellen, do we want to talk about common defenses to public employees?
I think we should, yeah. What are the common defenses, actually?
The common disparate treatment.
What does that mean, disparate treatment?
That other employees who have done the same thing that you're charging me with haven't been discharged or disciplined.
At the same level.
The other defense is that it didn't happen. It didn't happen the way you're saying it happened.
And then another one is a lack of progressive discipline. Chuck, this is a big thing in public sector disciplinary cases. And basically what that principle, progressive discipline, means that if an employee commits an act of misconduct, and is disciplined for it, let's say with a 5-day suspension, that if they commit that same act again further on in their employment, that their next level of discipline should be more severe than a 5-day suspension, because obviously it didn't work to remediate their conduct, to turn them back into a productive employee or whatever it may have been that their act of misconduct was.
Mm-hmm. And failure to train, that you hadn't trained, that the employee hadn't been trained that this was required on the,
yeah.
And or that I did, I followed procedure, and this is what happened, and that you didn't provide me with the resources that I needed to properly do what you think I should have done. That there aren't enough in the public sector. There's been the layoffs and things, and that there aren't enough employees to do all the work.
Chuck, and Ellen, one thing that I would often raise, because I actually started off after I left the LA County District Attorney's Office, I represented law enforcement unions for some time and their members. And, typically what I would try to do when I was on the union side would be to pick apart the investigation that was done into my client's misconduct. to poke holes in either the way that it was investigated, a potential conflict of interest with the person who investigated it, or just a lack of support of hard evidence to support the conclusions that the investigator drew. And if, in fact, you're able to really hit on any of those, that comes across pretty effectively to arbitrators and hearing officers. And obviously, when you're successful in doing so, it's a powerful tool to be able to use
to provide a good defense. It's true that when you're putting on a case in front of an arbitrator and you have a coworker who says, I saw the charged party do what you're saying he's doing. You know, I always ask, did you have a beef with that person? Would he have some reason to want to get back at you for something? And is there some ulterior motive for him saying these things?
Let me ask you this, both of you. Obviously, you're talking about things that are not within the court process. There's been no lawsuit filed in the Superior Court in California. Is there, in the procedures that we're talking about, the due process procedures for public employees, is there the ability of the public employee as well as the public entity to take depositions where you have a court reporter, where the person, whether it's the employer, that is the manager, or whether it's the employee? Go ahead.
Typically not, Chuck. There's really not opportunity in a public sector administrative hearing to conduct depositions.
I see.
But the way that that's remedied and how it plays out at the administrative hearing is that the rules of evidence are more loosely interpreted. More evidence is generally allowed into the administrative record than it would be in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
So from a union perspective, you could present stuff you'd have no chance of getting in a superior court.
Like what? Give us an example. What would you like to get in?
Hearsay is admissible at these hearings.
So you can throw in hearsay.
Correct. Yeah, hearsay comes in. The decision can't be based on hearsay alone, though. It's a tricky concept. Yes, it comes in.
Character evidence. I mean, character evidence is pretty difficult to get in a superior court setting. However, arbitrators, one of the ways in which they can be overturned is by not allowing an appellant to present evidence. So they're more apt to allow character evidence in an administrative hearing, whereas in a superior court, you'd probably get laughed at by the judge for trying to even raise the issue.
Can you, one question before we end our statewide version, which we're going to end in about half a minute or so. Is there anything that an employee can do to make sure that he or she is being properly represented in a hearing like this? Who's paying this? The public employee is paying for this, he or herself. Is that right?
The union is typically footing the bill for the administrative hearing and usually the counsel that represents them in the administrative hearing. But what I would say to that, having been on the past side, the union side as well in the past, is to be an advocate for yourself. Demand that whoever's representing you in the hearing be responsive to you, that they inform you, that you, have input on decisions that are made about your administrative hearing, because ultimately it's your job on the line. It's your money out of your pocket if it's a suspension without pay.
We have come to the end of the statewide version of the program. We'll be back to you on that in just a moment, if you would, Alfonso. This is Your Legal Rights, everybody. I want to let you know again that this is our regular Call a Lawyer night, where you can speak to one of several attorneys who are here at the station, KALW in San Francisco. We do this normally on the fourth Wednesday of the month. The number is 1-800-525-9917. If you would like to ask a question about workers' compensation law, Alice O'Sullivan, certified specialist in workers' comp, will take your calls during the course of the program. Her number is 510-333-3314, 510-333-3314. Here at the studio is criminal law certified specialist Jeff Hayden. He just was relieved as being the president of the San Mateo County Bar Association. I think he's got a little bit more time now since he's not has to deal with that. We have Janet Lee Frankel, who's a certified specialist in family law. We have Sal Timpano in landlord-tenant law. We have Taki Asanehi, employment law. We have Frank Adam for tax law, real estate. law. He's also a real estate broker for patent law, aviation law, lemon law. We have Ron Rohde. Tomorrow, if you're being chased by creditors, Leon Bayer will be available. Leon is a certified specialist in bankruptcy law. He'll be at his office. That's tomorrow, Thursday, January 28th, between 8 and noon. And again, no obligation on your part, again, whatsoever. It's 1-800-477-3111. 1-800-477-3111 if you want to speak to Leon Bayer tomorrow. All right, I want to invite you to call in. If you have a question, it doesn't have to be about public employees. If you have questions in the other areas of employment law, please don't hesitate to call. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Alfonso, let me let the listeners know who you are, because some people may have come in a little bit late. This is Your Legal Rights. We're doing a program on employment law. We started with a focus on due process rights of public employees. My guests are employment law attorneys Ellen Mendelson, who represents public employees. Her office is in San Francisco. Alfonso Estrada, who represents public entities. He's an associate in the Cerritos, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo. And so if you would like to call in with your question, your comment, or whatever, please do so. 866-798-8255. Don't be bashful, and please don't wait until the last 5 minutes of the program, because then it's just too late. Alfonso, I cut you off in the last couple of minutes. Please continue with what you were talking about.
No, I had concluded. The question was, you know, what can a union member who's going through a disciplinary matter with their employer, you know, which can be a stressful moment in their life, what should they do to ensure that their rights are being advocated properly? And my advice there was just, you know, be an advocate for yourself, be involved in your disciplinary matter, be in contact with your advocate and or attorney, and, you know, make sure your input is a part of your defense of the charges brought against you.
When you say your advocate or an attorney, who is your advocate? Who is that?
In the union context, that's frequently the business agent or your shop steward. Yeah. And it is most unions do not provide attorneys for members.
Is that because of the expense of an attorney?
Certainly because of the expense. The police unions, generally law enforcement, fire, frequently will provide attorneys, although actually fire, strike that. Law enforcement will frequently provide attorneys for their members because there are groups that do that. But the average union member is not going to get representation from legal counsel paid for by their employer.
That's true.
Is that a basic problem, then, for a public employee? I mean, Alfonso, here you are. You're a former deputy DA for L.A. County. You then were an attorney for a union. Now you're on the other side representing public entities. Is there an inherent problem here or a disadvantage that a public employee has who is a member of a union if the union does not supply an attorney to represent this person?
I guess my answer to that would be not necessarily. These advocates for these unions receive training themselves from attorneys. They're versed in how these administrative hearings proceed. And there are some very good advocates out there.
Okay.
I don't want to denigrate what they do.
All right. I'm not trying to hammer anyone. I'm just concerned about people getting fair treatment.
Well, it's always prudent to consult an attorney when charged, when there's a possibility of losing your pay.
And who would you consult with, Ellen?
You can call the San Francisco Bar Association.
Yeah.
There's an entire panel of attorneys who do public employee work.
Mm-hmm.
You can look on the Internet and find attorneys who do public employee work in your area. You can talk to other public employees to see if they know of anybody who does that kind of work.
Okay, you as the individual, you as the public employee, you've got to do some work yourself, though, to realize that you want to have the best defense you can have.
Correct.
Okay. Let me do this before we take our first call. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, and I bring this up because both the Lawyer Referral Service of the San Francisco Bar as well as the San Mateo County Bar are funders of this program. The San Mateo County Bar also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours, 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own. Hopefully you will be able to speak to a human being during business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to try to find someone who's experienced in that area of law. Set you up with a half an hour consultation with that attorney. You will pay, with minor exception in California, somewhere between $25 to $35 for that half an hour consultation. That $25 to $35 does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to continue that kind of great public service. All right, Jane, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Jane,
Hi, go ahead. I'm a public employee, and I had a pretty serious bout of cancer. I was out for about 9 months and managed to have extended leave because of I had a lot of vacation accumulated and some donated by my colleagues. And when I came back, at first they were okay with me coming back at like 60%, and they are saying that I need to go back to 100%, even though my doctors don't want me to be at 100%. So what kind of rights might I have?
Is that what you're confronted with right now, Jane? Your doctor is permitting you to continue on a 50% basis at work, but your employer wants you to do 100%. Is that what you are confronted with right now?
Yeah.
And are you represented by an attorney by any chance?
No. I'm getting some indication that maybe for another 3 months I could go up to 80%, but basically that my position has to be 100%.
All right. And you work for a public entity, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. If you'll turn your radio back up, let me get some comments for you that might give you some direction. Ellen, do you want to start, please?
In terms of, have you been to your union?
Well,
no union representation. I'm in management.
Oh, your management.
Oh, your management.
Well,
okay.
And you were out. You've been out. Generally, a job is only protected for 12 weeks.
Generally speaking? Really?
Generally, under the California Family Rights Act and the Family and Medical Leave Act,
I think you're referring to her right to reinstatement to the same position before she went out on the leave.
Yes.
Correct. She's seeking, and they don't have to give you another job. They have to accommodate you to do your job. Is there anybody else they've reduced hours for in a similar situation?
No, they've been accommodating me so far in terms of being at 60%. But the light is dimming at the end of this tunnel. You know, at some point I have to go to 100%, or I will lose my position.
Do you have an outstanding workers' compensation claim?
No.
No? So this has all just been handled kind of informally through your doctors and your employer?
Oh, yeah. It's not related to workers' comp.
Okay. So now, basically, your doctor's saying you're not able to work more than 60%. They're seeking to have you come back in a more full-time basis. And you're trying to set up some kind of structured return where possibly in 3 months you can come back 80%.
Yeah, I mean, I'm at that point right now. I've been back 3 months at 60, and you know, we're going to start for another 3 months at 80, but they're not going to let this keep going.
Have they put that in writing, Jane?
Good question.
Have they put that in writing, Jane?
No,
not yet. They've just told you that. But what recommendation, Alfonso, since you've been on both sides of this, what recommendation would you have for Jane as someone who's in management?
Well, the first thing I would have asked, which is what Ellen asked, is do you have a union? Here you're not in that position. So what I would do is definitely consult with an attorney, specifically kind of trying to figure out exactly, you know, what the limitations are on what the employer can require you to do, with the understanding that they are not required to, you know, hold this position at a 60% level, kind of in perpetuity. At some point, the employer also has rights to decide whether they, you know, need to make alternative arrangements, or whether they can, in fact, you know, potentially release you from your employment. So I think the best thing you could possibly do is just to speak to an attorney who, you know, deals with medical disability rights, and get an informed second opinion from them as to, you know, what your rights are, what you can do, what the employer can do, and just kind of educate yourself about the process at this point.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah, Jane, do you have some contact that you feel comfortable with where you can try to find an attorney who knows something about medical disability rights, or is this all misto magic to you at this point?
Yeah, I would have to probably call the Bar Association.
Well, I think you should. You're in Santa Clara County, right?
Yes.
I would call the Bar Association and Lawyer Referral Office and see if they can help. If not, you can call my office. If the Bar Association can't help you, I'll be happy to try to help you. You don't know me, of course, but I am a deputy DA for San Mateo County. If you want to call me at my office, the San Mateo County DA's office, and say you listen to the program and you want to talk with me, I'm happy to call you back, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, okay, Jane, take care. All right, everybody, let me remind you again, it's our regular Call a Lawyer night, the fourth Wednesday of the month. We're on January 27th. It's going too fast, everybody. It's going too fast. Alice O'Sullivan will take your calls through the course of this program. Her number is 510-333-3314 for workers' compensation law. She's an outstanding and very experienced workers' compensation attorney, former chair of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Jeff Hayden, who's a criminal law specialist, is here. For family law, Janet Lee Frankel, a certified specialist. For landlord-tenant law, Sal Timpano. For employment law, Taki Astanehi. For tax law, real estate, who's also a real estate broker, Frank Adam. For patent law, aviation law, Lemon Law, Ron Rohde. They are here, and that's 1-800-525-9917. And if you're being chased by your creditors, Leon Baer, certified specialist in bankruptcy law, will be available to speak with you. No obligation on your part whatsoever. He'll be available tomorrow, Thursday, January 28th, 8 a.m. to noon, 1-800-477-3111, 1-800-477-3111. If you call and the line is busy, but you can leave a message, leave your name and phone number, and that you're a listener to Your Legal Rights, and Mr. Baer will call you back. All right, we've got Carol. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. My concern is finding the right employee so that the fit is spectacular. It's a win-win situation, and we don't have to face any disappointment of firing. And my question is, can I do that with a paid internship of 3 months or even longer, and then choose from there?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Carol. You said find the right employee. Is that what you meant to say?
Yes. In other words, in hiring people,
so that
we don't have a problem of firing them, and everyone is happy, and we know that the fit is perfect. So can I arrange something instead, like a paid internship, and then choose from there? So
you're talking about the private
yes.
employer situation.
Yes.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, let me get some comments on that, Carol. You are an employer, are you?
Yes.
You're
okay.
an employer, and you're seeking to hire somebody to work for you, and you want it to be the right fit.
Yes.
And she wants a period of 3 months to see whether or not this is going to work.
Well, you can have a period of time in which they're probationary.
Sure.
Where everybody has that. Even public entities have that. Some have 6 months. For some positions, it's a year. And while probationary, and actually that's something we didn't discuss, Alfonso.
That's true.
Is the probationary, when any reason or no reason, you can fire somebody. So if it's not a good fit, and I know that most employers don't like firing people either.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't need a reason to fire them. It's any reason or no reason, subject to the caveat that it can't be a discriminatory reason.
Well, if as Carol's talking about, this probationary period of 3 months to see whether or not this is a good fit, is it wise, and I ask both of you this, Ellen and Alfonso, is it wise under these circumstances so that the cards are on the table, everybody's up front with each other, the employer and the employee, to put this in writing?
Very wise.
Yes, absolutely.
Every employer should have the rules related to the position in writing and provide them to the employee and get a signed receipt back. And
under penalty of perjury.
No.
I'm just joking.
And employers need to have written policies concerning what to do if an employee believes they're a victim of discrimination or harassment. And that policy will help protect the employer in the event the employee claims somewhere down the road that I was a victim of discrimination or harassment. The employer can say, well, look, this is what you're supposed to do if you believe you were. Did you do those things?
Yeah, and Carol, just kind of adding one thing. Well, first of all, my initial response, yes, you can do that, and I think that's a good practice. Second of all, if you are going to do so, a good tool that you can arm yourself with to protect against any future litigation down the road would be to kind of do monthly evaluations of that employee. Memorialize them, put them into writing, and if at the end of that three-month period you ultimately decide to release the employee, therefore you'll have, you know, these three evaluations that you've done monthly of the employee, why he's not meeting your expectations, and why you ultimately decided to release him from his paid internship.
And Alfonso, when you do the evaluation, the monthly evaluation, am I correct that this is something in terms of how the employer should deal with this, is that you will, at the end of the first month, and you do the monthly evaluation in writing, you will give a copy of this to the employee?
You can, you would want to review that with the employee, give them a copy, let them know what your expectations are, why they're not meeting them, and then kind of proceed from there, do it again, and then that way, if at the end of the three-month period you're not satisfied with the employee, one, you could release them because they're at will,
mm-hmm.
but two, you'll have documentation to kind of protect yourself from anything coming down the road, potential curveball from this employee filing a claim or a lawsuit or something of that nature.
Carol, do you have an attorney?
No.
Okay. Now, should Carol, at this point, if she's really serious about making sure...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Should she get an attorney or not?
Well, if she runs into problems, I know.
I'm trying to avoid problems.
Yeah, and certainly if you're starting a business at which you're going to be having employees, there are If you're in San Francisco, for instance, we have the sick leave law, and there's a bunch of laws that you have to follow.
Yeah.
That if you add the minimum wage requirements and the overtime requirements on, it's very tricky for employers.
Carol, a quick question would be
what would be the difference between probationary period or internship? There must be a legal differentiation, I'm assuming.
Well, for a probationary period typically deals with public employees, and when any public employee is hired, they pretty much universally have a probationary period.
Okay.
If they get in any severe acts of misconduct or commit any severe acts of misconduct, they can be released from probation, and they don't have the normal rights that a fully vested civil service protected public employee would have. But in the private sector, you know, a paid internship versus a probationary period, there is no significant difference between the two.
The hallmark of the employment relationship is the employer's right to control what you do, when you do, how you do, where you do, all up to the employer. So that if you want to call it an internship, or a probation, and there's no, it's what you call it. And you still have to pay an intern minimum wage, and they still are entitled to 10-minute breaks for every three and a half hours worked, and a half an hour lunch period for every 5 hours worked, and overtime for anything over 8 hours.
Carol, I would highly suggest to you, I think you're in Santa Clara County, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay. I would highly suggest to you that you might want to contact the Santa Clara County Bar Lawyer Referral Service and at least get an initial half-an-hour consultation with an employment law attorney who represents employers. You know, there are attorneys who represent employees, attorneys who represent employers. This is probably something that you should do. I want to take one more call. Good luck to you, Carol.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Carol.
Take care. I hope it works out. Alex, pardon me, welcome to Your Legal Rights. And by the way, there's a question before, Alex, you ask yours, and it is, isn't an intern someone learning on the job, and does that make a difference?
My gut reaction to that is, an intern is a new employee learning on the job, but it's really not different than any employee who comes into a new job.
Okay.
It's just kind of a term that you associate with somebody, you know, either in college, doing an internship, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But ultimately, an intern, just like an employee, is learning how to do a job.
Okay. My feeling, again, is that I think it's very important for people who are doing something like this, especially as Carol has suggested, to get professional advice initially. Be willing to spend initially at least $35 to get a half an hour consultation and go from there. All right, Alex, you've got the last question. Go ahead.
I actually wanted to say that I'm a labor representative for the public sector here in California in the Bay Area, and I want to clarify some points that have been made.
Go ahead.
About asking for advice. One of your panelists recommended for people to go out and talk to a lawyer right away if they're being disciplined. And under California law, under PERB, the Myers-Milius Prone Act, unions are the exclusive bargaining representatives, and a lot of the employment issues are covered by union contracts. We have members or represented employees that go out and get a lawyer on their own and don't talk to their union rep, and it causes a lot of confusion. A lot of times because the legal help they get doesn't understand public employee law, which is very specific, and they don't really realize that the procedures outlined in the contracts are exclusively represented by the union, and the union has to be involved with those processes a lot of the times.
But Alex,
so in order to avoid that confusion, they really should contact their labor rep immediately, and almost all unions have legal counsel that they work with, or they even have legal counsel on staff.
But what Alex, what you are talking about, though, is where the employee, the union, the member of the union, has gone out without telling the union, hey, I'm being threatened with discipline or being disciplined, and had gone directly to a lawyer rather than communicating that to the union itself. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where, you know, someone goes off on their own and they don't understand the situation, because, you know, in this situation, the union is going to be much more averse than most lawyers, or the union's going to have their own legal counsel involved from the very beginning.
Okay.
And that'll actually, you know,
in my experience, Alex, I hate to interrupt you, but in my experience, the discipline is served on both the union and the employee. Generally in my practice, I try to work as closely with the union as I can on things. And basically, if the union isn't going to grieve it, or if the union isn't going to do anything, and, you know, they unions know what they can win and what they cannot. They are very familiar with how decisions come down. And
I think that the important thing here, too, is that the unions move forward based on the merits of the case, and that's the duty of fair representation that unions have. And that it's very important that employees and members understand that a lot of times the arbitration clause in a contract is owned by the union, and so the union gets to decide if something goes to arbitration or not. And, you know, if the merits of the case are bad, and you have an employee that really doesn't have a shot, but they went and got their own legal counsel, you know, the union's probably going to say, you know what, like, we reviewed your case, and you don't get to go to arbitration because your case is terrible and you clearly did this, whatever it was.
I want to get a comment from Alfonso on that. What comment do you have, if anything? Yeah. We have 1 minute left in the program.
Sure. I don't really disagree with much of what Alex said. Obviously, if you have a union, you should consult with them first. And typically, in my experience, unions do have their own counsel. So I don't really disagree with anything Alex said. And I don't think Ellen and I said anything contrary.
I don't think so either.
No.
I don't think so either. I'm the one, Alex, that you're probably admonishing, because I believe that people should learn as much as they can about what their rights are and what their obligations are. So it may be that I said something that got you thinking that my guest had said something else. I think we've essentially come to the end of the program, Alex. Maybe we'll do another program on this. And if you want to get in touch with me at KALW, I'd be very happy to have you as a guest on a future program if you'd like to do that.
It would be my pleasure. And I just wanted to make sure I clarified, to make sure everyone understood what the best course of action was. So thank you for your time.
Yeah. Hey, thank you very much.
Alex.
Thank you very much for calling. I greatly appreciate it, Alex. I look forward to hearing from you, frankly. All right, everybody. I want to thank you, both of you. We never have enough time for this. Ellen Mendelson, who represents Public Employees Office in San Francisco. Ellen, great to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you very
great
much.
Great to see you, Chuck.
And Alfonso Estrada, great to hear you, Alfonso.
Chuck, great to meet you.
With the phone working tonight, Alfonso is an associate in the Cerritos, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo, and he represents public entities. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Chuck.
I wanted to let you all know what we're doing next week. We're going to be doing federal bankruptcy law, actually. My friend Leon Baer will be one of the guests. We're going to be talking about the five myths about filing federal bankruptcy, whatever they are. My guests are Leon Baer and Michael O'Halloran, specialists in federal bankruptcy law who are certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. That's what we're doing next week. My assistants on this program, I shouldn't say my assistants, I must say the program engineer is Joanne Marr, production assistant is Martin McLean. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding of the program is by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, the San Mateo County Bar Association, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. For those of you who still want to do it, we have a couple of minutes left with the Call a Lawyer, 1-800-525-9917. The lawyers are still here. on January 27th. I thank you for listening to Your Legal Rights Public Radio on this public radio station, and I hope you join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney. Join us again. Take care. Bye.